This week, we're staying home and sharing highlights from the new Interfaith Alliance Facebook Live series, Stay Home, Stay Focused, conducted by Alliance President Jack Moline.
And I'm very pleased to have as my guest today, author Catherine Stewart, who is the author of Power Worshippers Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. So maybe you can tell our viewers and listeners who may know the words but not the concept, what exactly is religious nationalism?
Well, the first thing to know about religious nationalism is that it's not religion. It's a political ideology that cloaks itself in religious rhetoric. Its representatives insist that the foundation of legitimate government is bound up with a reactionary understanding of a particular religion or certain approved religions. And it basically says that the United States is founded on the Bible and can succeed only if it stays true to this foundation. Religious nationalism is also a device, a very effective device, I should say, for mobilizing and often manipulating large segments of the population and for concentrating power in the hands of a new elite. So I want to say about something about what it's not. It's not a religion, obviously. And it's also not about evangelicals. It includes many evangelicals. The movement excludes many evangelicals, too. And it includes representatives of a variety of Protestant and non-Protestant faiths. And what unites the movement is not any sort of theological distinctions, but more of a political vision.
Is this brand of religious nationalism unique to the United States, or does it have historical parallels and antecedents around the world?
That's a great question, and it is not remotely unique to the United States. When you look at other leaders around the world, if you look at, say, what Vladimir Putin does in Russia, or Orban does in Hungary, or Erdogan does in Turkey, when these folks, you know, leaders bind themselves very tightly with religious conservatives, leaders in their countries in order to consolidate a more authoritarian form of power, we rightly recognize this as a form of religious nationalism. And that's what we're seeing here, I think, with Trump's alliances with our own sort of religious hyper-conservatives.
There are lots of conservatives and perhaps even liberals who are traditionalists who read the Bible or who read whatever their scripture is as being the moving force throughout history. Mm-hmm. Now, here they are in the United States and being accused of what they perceive as something that is entirely consistent much longer than the history of the United States.
Right. Well, I think it's important to know that not everybody who lends support to a religious nationalist agenda or a Christian nationalist agenda will self-identify as Christian nationalists, of course. But I think when you look at the structure, the infrastructure of the movement and how it's sort of captured. So basically one of our political parties that what other people might view, what they might identify as religion is really, the rest of us can identify as a kind of partisan political agitation.
Well, certainly we've seen that at Interfaith Alliance and spoken out about it consistently. What would a country look like if the religious nationalists were to succeed in their objectives?
Well, I think there are nuances specific to different countries, and we can see what has happened in different countries around the world where religious conservatives have been used in order, you know, by these sort of autocratic leaders to consolidate a more authoritarian form of power. So, you know, we see examples of this around the world. And another thing, you know, something that's really, you know, specific to the United States is this is an inherently pluralistic country, and our diversity is irreducible. And when one particular form of religion tries to sort of establish a hierarchy of rights, the rights of people who sort of believe correctly to discriminate against those who do not believe supposedly correctly, you're going to end up with all kinds of, division. I mean, I think, look, the separation of church and state is not a legal technicality or something just for atheists. It's a principle that served our country very well since our nation's founding and has held our country together, even as so many others have been torn apart by sectarian division.
You know, it's sort of a catch-22, or perhaps the reverse of a catch-22, that some of the folks who are the leading proponents of religious nationalism, using the language of religion, are claiming they have a right to promote what they believe in because they're protected by the First Amendment. What's the response to that?
Well, when you look at the First Amendment, the religious nationalists have very effectively used the free speech clause, for instance, to demolish the establishment clause, which is a separate and distinct clause in our First Amendment. I don't think our founders intended to put in superfluous clauses in our Constitution. It also, by the way, has the best piece of real estate in our Constitution, the very First Amendment. And those two pieces, the first, the religion clause is the establishment piece and the free exercise piece, they're both very important. And there is a kind of necessary tension between the two. And I believe that tension is quite deliberate. And it is also separate and distinct from the free speech clause. Now, a lot of times religious nationalists, Christian nationalists, will say they're just trying to exercise their free speech rights when they say want to allow adults in public schools to preach to children. They say, well, these are free speech rights. Well, you know, they claim what they're doing is just speech when they want to sort of force their initiatives in public schools, or when they want to, they say, we just want to be treated by everybody else. But is religion just like free speech, like any other? I mean, not according to our tax code. In our tax code, religious groups are treated very differently and privileged above other non-religious nonprofits. They receive, you know, certain kinds of subsidies and special deductions that other forms of religious nonprofit don't have to. They don't have to open their books and adhere to the same financial transparency requirements. Religious groups are not treated the same way as other for-profit and non-profit groups in our legal code. They're allowed to discriminate. They're allowed to discriminate against people of other faiths. They're allowed to exclude women from leadership positions. Until recently, many religions excluded people of color from different leadership positions and things like that. So, you know, a lot of times, Christian nationalists, they claim they are just speech like any other when they want to force their initiatives in public schools and into government, but then they retreat and say, oh, no, we're religion, so please give us our special privileges and subsidies and exemptions. You know, really, they're trying to have it both ways.
You know, in all of the tumult that's going on surrounding the coronavirus and the restrictions that have been placed on our lives, we are very, very focused on rightly keeping ourselves and our families healthy and safe. Is there stuff going on we should nonetheless be paying attention to in this realm of the advancement of religious nationalism that's happening under the radar because of our focus directed toward these health concerns?
I think there are a number of ways in which the religious right bears some responsibility for the current incompetence in our national response. And remember, my particular concern here is not with religious creed. It's really with a political movement that cloaks itself in religious rhetoric.
Right.
So here are the ways, first and foremost. I think that the movement promotes a kind of anti-science culture that rejects the evidence of science and rejects expertise and critical thinking. And that has obviously contributed, I think, to our administration's inability to handle this crisis in an evidence-based fashion. Misinformation is also rife in some of those hyper-conservative and highly politicized communities that were all in for Trump. Now, secondly, this is becoming really obvious right now, unfortunately, is that we have a poorly developed collective infrastructure, and that too is a consequence of right-wing economic, sort of far-right economic policy and government bashing, and the religious right is implicated in that as well. That movement has allied itself for many years with sort of hyper-libertarian economic, you know, conservative wing of the Republican Party, and so it does share some of the blame that falls on that group. I mean, we have a collective health problem, And it's really hard to have collective solutions, especially healthcare solutions, when you have a cohort that's been bashing everything that government does and say, you know, government is never doing anything good. You know, it's just led to the privatization of the healthcare system, the depletion of really important organizations like the CDC and kind of pandemic response, and the tearing down of the social safety net. Right now, I'm concerned, I think every American is, regardless of where they stand on the political spectrum, I'm really concerned about our most economically vulnerable citizens. And yet the religious right has gone so far as to call government-funded programs like food stamps unbiblical. Folks at the Family Research Council or in some of these other right-wing policy groups are saying that government assistance to the poor, direct government assistance to the poor, is against the biblical model. So I think that's an enormous reason why we're ill-prepared for this crisis. Now, a third point is, you know, in the Trump years, we've seen a kind of breakdown of formal expertise and an increasing premium paid for political loyalty and ideological conformity. Some of the folks that Trump surrounds himself, they're not there because they're experts in their field, but because they're willing to praise the president or perhaps prostrate themselves and before him, and are guided perhaps by kind of you know, that sort of far-right economic policy or even pursuit of power and profit. And they, you know, some of them may have little interest in serving the wider public interest. And I think that's really, you know, when you have a problem like a global pandemic, you really need to have the smartest people in the room. You need to have epidemiological experts, people who really understand how pandemics work and how they spread and how they're contained. And, you know, a final point I want to make is that the movement has unfortunately driven the party, the Republican Party, toward hyper-partisanization, sort of religious nationalism. You know, you used to see more sort of collaboration between the Democratic and Republican parties, and there was more of a kind of balance and a more cooperation when it was necessary. But these days, unfortunately, I think thanks to the influence of religious nationalism, there's a kind of all spin, all politics view of the world in the Republican Party. You know, everything is spun for political gain. So perhaps this is why so many movement leaders greeted the news of the coronavirus, even in March when it was clear what was happening, as an insult to Trump. I mean, Jerry Falwell Jr. went on television, Fox News, on March 13th and called news of the coronavirus hype. And he kind of called it overreaction, and he said it was an attempt to so-called, you know, quote-unquote, get Trump. I mean, one of the most tragic consequences of this kind of fact-free hyper-partisanship is competent government, and that's what's most needed today.
I'm sitting here in Virginia having this conversation with you, and we're extremely aware of what was going on in Lynchburg with Liberty University and Jerry Falwell Jr.'s pronouncements. The governor has been sort of parrying back and forth with him without either of them mentioning each other's names. So I know where you're coming from on that one for sure. Our allies and our board members, who indeed consider themselves to be secularists or non-believers in a deist tradition, often come under the accusation that when they attack a self-defined religious community, they're merely exercising their own demons and not making an honest argument, but trying to justify where they step away from received tradition in some of these other circumstances. If you were advising people on how to respond to that, what would you say?
Well, again, separation of church and state is not just for atheists. It's a constitutional principle. It's baked into the very first clause of our very First Amendment. I don't think that, being faithful to our constitutional principles, being a patriot, honoring a diversity, honoring, you know, all kinds of diversity in our country, religious diversity for sure, and true religious freedom, freedom of conscience, is not an attack on any particular faith community.
Or even an attack on faith communities in general.
No, of course not. I mean, I think that here's another thing. I mean, this is often cast as an attack on evangelicalism, but it's the movement, again, doesn't just, it excludes many evangelicals. There's, I mean, let's not forget that there's a large community of evangelicals in our country that reject the politics of division and conquest that this movement represents. I think religious nationalists save some of their most poisonous words for those to identify as Christians of a different sort. The movement has set itself against religious liberalism for well over a century, and they try to sideline religious progressive voices precisely because they're so threatening to a form of nationalism that endorses a kind of strict biblical literalism, hierarchies of people that they claim to be ordained in the Bible in an earlier era. Those hierarchies included racial hierarchies. Now they've kind of stepped away from that a little bit, although it's some implicit in the movement. And mm-hmm. in some ways, I think movement leaders tend to paper over the ways in which hyper-conservative religion and racism can reinforce one another. But you know, this sort of promotion of this idea that there's a sort of insider and outsider, a pure and the impure.
Right.
And they asked, you know, here's another thing. They'll lump, you know, religious progressives into that same bucket as non-religious, because, you know, that's a, and then they claim that secularists are out there ransacking everything that is good and holy in society. And yet those who defend the principle of equality, defend pluralism, and seek to uphold our constitutional principles, I believe are the true patriots in our society.
And the irony of this, at least from our interfaith perspective, is that the groups in the United States that are most often the targets of this religious nationalist rhetoric are those who are accused of trying to impose an outside set of values on true American values, whether it's the Muslim community or the Asian community or the Jewish community. They are accused by these religious nationalists of trying to do exactly the thing that religious nationalists are trying to do to the Constitution.
It's interesting. They are actually playing a kind of identity politics, because
right.
tying the idea of what a legitimate American, like, you know, the true American identity with certain approved religious and also cultural identities. So it's a form of identity politics for sure. And you know, it's really all about ideological conformity.
Catherine, this has been a wonderful conversation, and I can't thank you enough for being with us. Recommend one thing to people who are watching this or listening to this at home that they could do to inspire them or engage them beyond their concerns about COVID-19. What would you suggest to them?
You know, the right has succeeded in, you know, capturing our government, capturing one of our political parties, because they've invested for decades in the infrastructure of modern political campaigns, data and media and messaging. They've created a positive voting culture. They make people feel, no matter how, you know, old they might be or how they're disabled, it doesn't matter. Like, your vote matters. You matter. They're really great at sort of making people feel like their vote really counts. And I think that sometimes there's a lot of bickering and fighting. You know, in a way, it's easier to unite a smaller group around a radical core than it is to unite the opposition, which is really united only in its opposition to that sort of radicalism.
Right.
And you know, the idea of those sort of strict hierarchies and the sort of authoritarianism. So, but the right unites when it's necessary. I don't think they were all in for Trump from the beginning. There are a number of movement leaders that go to these strategy meetings or the gatherings that they hold. And I don't think they were all in for Trump in the beginning. But once it was clear that he was their guy, they all got in line, because they know that if they're united, that's how they win. And I think we can learn from them a little bit in that way.
Well, it's a good reason to stay focused.
Yeah.
Catherine Stewart, author of Power Worshippers Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism, thank you for being with us. And to all of you watching and listening, stay home, stay focused.